Okay, we're up and running again. And I'll just make this go big. There we go. Okay, well, welcome back.
Too late. You're all locked out. Don't know who they were.
Probably should know who they were. Oh, well. All right, here's the plan. We've got an hour and a half. I'm going to talk about what I call the evolving concept of the community of practice because it's changed dramatically in the last 5 years or so from where it began to where it's going. That's going to segue nicely into a discussion, a more concrete discussion of personalization. I'll talk about RSS and some of the mechanisms that I've used to produce highly specific, highly targeted information feeds that will inevitably, without a doubt, produce the sort of output that I talked about at the beginning of the session today with the recipes and things like that showing up on your kitchen cupboard door. Or for that matter, learning showing up anywhere in any environment, because that is really the direction that we're moving in my opinion. And it's my opinion, so it must be right. I will preface by saying, I mean, there is an element of contingency to a lot of this. As I commented last Saturday, networks are a lot like ecosystems, and as such, they can be broken. They are broken. So there are ways to make this not happen. And there are many people out there who are trying to prevent this sort of thing from happening and making sure that there is no such thing as a free information flow. But I think, you know, and I don't think forces of history are inevitable or anything like that. I think what happens in history is based on decisions that people make. But I think that overall, people will opt for something like the network picture that I'm describing, if not sooner, then certainly in the longer run. But it might take a while to get there, depending on, you know, just how widespread this copyright mess becomes, just how pervasive proprietary technology becomes. It's pretty pervasive now, but there is a reaction going against it. But that's all by way of preface. I want to focus on, as I said, the evolving concept of the community of practice. I've had lots of involvement in communities of practice over the years, but I'm by no means the inventor of the concept. The inventors, well, the person most often credited as being the inventor of the concept is someone called Etienne Wenger. Last time I talked about this, I mispronounced his name through the entire session. Sometimes you look really stupid when you do talks. And he begins with the ordinary and the everyday. Communities of practice are a part of our everyday lives. They are pervasive. They are informal. They are the sort of thing, as I was talking about before the break, people calling up people that they know, who they think will know on the telephone. And that creates a community of practice. So, to Wenger, communities of practice have always been with us. The community of practice of philosophers sitting around, the table. I don't know if they had tables. They must have had tables. With Socrates or Plato, the people at the academy, the Stoa, and so on through history. Guilds and things like that are classic examples of communities of practice in the pre-technology days. This is Wenger again. What communities of practice do? Facilitate collaboration. In other words, allow the members to be able to work together. Provide answers to specific questions from subject matter experts. I did a summary of a talk. It was by, name escapes me, Aaron Brewer. Talking about the use of Yahoo groups as communities of practice. And she did a study of four specific groups. The one that really sticks in my mind is the beekeeping group. And a bunch of people got together in a Yahoo group and talked beekeeping. And that's what they talked about. Very interesting. So anyhow, she did an analysis of this the types of communication that happened, the negotiations that happened between people trying to learn and experts that were there. And one of the types of information that very clearly is transmitted in a environment such as this is expert knowledge from people who really know bees to people who know less about bees. Filtering out incorrect information. We saw this in Wikipedia. Had I entered Google Rocks on the Christopher Reeves page, it would have lasted less than 5 minutes. Somebody would have, especially today, I guess, somebody would have filtered it out. Capturing institutional knowledge and reusing it. This is your characteristic water cooler talk, right? There's the manual, and then there's the way things really work. And the way things really work is the information that's shared among people in the community of practice, typically in a place of work. Sharing things that work, preventing or... I don't like best practices really so much as a concept, but the idea of, you know, this is how you go about doing such and such. You want to get a contract from Fodsworth, this is what you got to do. You got to take them to the bar, you know, best practices. Stillwinder, the salient features of practice, the important things that make a community of practice and not, say, a mob. Shared domain of interest. Communities of practice are about something. Typically, they're not. They may be fairly precise. There's the community of practice around HO scale railways. They may be fairly broad. Mini Mall was the community of practice around municipal government in Alberta, which turns out to be a very broad topic. Crosses organizational, operational, and functional boundaries. This is something that a lot of, because I've read lots of stuff about communities of practice. You read about, oh, we're going to set up a community of practice inside our company, and thus proving that they've missed the point. The idea of a community of practice is that it crosses these company domains. It's the network operator in one company liaising directly with the network operator in another company, sharing information at that level. You see this an awful lot in the mailing groups and things like that. IT Forum or DOS-L are mailing groups with related to communities of practice in educational technology, and they are people from across organizations sharing information. It's defined by the scope of knowledge. I wanted to say the information of the data, but that's not what I mean. I mean the knowledge based on yesterday's talk. The way to describe it would be it's based on realms of common experience, right? Because knowledge, as I said yesterday, is experience. So a community of practice would be characterized to a large degree by the sharing of stories and experiences related to a particular field of endeavor or a particular domain. Now, here's the thing about community of practice within organizations. Again, I think this is a misrepresentation and a misunderstanding of communities of practice, but the slide is necessary because there's always a manager, right, who wants to set up a community practice and say, okay, well, let's get the policy manual together, we'll set out the parameters, but that's not how communities of practice work. They're informal. They're motivated by their enterprise, that is to say, the particular tasks, the particular things that members of the communities of practice are trying to do. They're not motivated by the company vision statement, for example. They're self-contained. They're self-governing. There isn't a manager of a community of practice. Community of practice isn't owned. It isn't controlled. And indeed, people have said outright, if you try to get a community of practice to produce deliverables, it'll kill it. And it really will kill it. I watch the... again, I mentioned yesterday on some of these standards bodies and so on. One of the ones that I sit on is something called the Learning Technology Subcommittee or whatever of IEEE Distance Right, Digital Rights Expression Language Committee. And this community has been given certain tasks under the heading of what they call the scope, and they have certain deliverables And it really has destroyed this community of practice. We have some of the top people in the field of digital rights in various organizations around the world. But they're so constrained by the parameters of this community that what they're producing isn't actually going to reflect what their shared expertise tells them. It's sad, really. Linger again, you cannot force a plant to grow by pulling its leaves. All you can do is create the infrastructure in which something like this prospers. On Saturday I talked a lot about the analogy between the network, the learning network, and the ecosystem. And this is partly where that kind of analogy comes from. It's just like the ecosystem can't be managed because otherwise you get a farm. In a similar way, you can't manage a community of practice. You end up with a whole bunch of people that are all like organization men. They're all identical. They're not producing anything unique. They're not actually sharing anything. They're simply conforming. More Wenger, three dimensions of a community of practice. We're sort of beginning to... I'm feeling like it's a little repetitive here, but it's a community practice is a joint enterprise understood and continually renegotiated by its members. If you think about some of the communities that you've seen online, and you really see this in action. A place like Slashdot, for example, one of Slashdot's favorite topics is Slashdot. Similarly, in the blogging community, the favorite topic of the blogging community is the blogging community. Communities of practice don't just look at the topic. They look inward. They look at themselves. They look at their own management, their own scope, their own objectives. They look at how the members will interact together. Slashdot has, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of members, a very large community. So they look at how it is that comments are ranked on a page, what the moderation system will be, if any, how we will admit new members. There's another site out there called MetaFilter. MetaFilter was so successful that the community simply decided, we're not going to let any new members in. People can come read us, but this is it. We're capping the membership. The last thing, the shared repertoire of communal resources, routines, sensibilities, artifacts, this is all, in my mind, straight from Kuhn. This is all the idea of knowing how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. What's shared in a community of practice isn't just knowledge, it's the vocabulary, it's the way of speaking, it's the world view. It's if you will, the intuition behind membership in a particular discipline or a domain. Or to come back to the way I express it, it's the experience. The experience of being a chemist. The experience of being a beekeeper. The experience of being a Linux hacker. I really should have a reference on this. On the other hand, this is my own observation as well. They do go through these stages, these communities. We've seen this in Usenet. We've seen this in mailing lists. One of the mailing lists that was very influential in my life was one called www.dev. And it started up as, well, nothing really. It was nothing but potential. But then in the early days, 94, 95, you could see it coming together. The people who were involved in creating learning for the web, web-based course delivery. What did they call it? Web-based courseware developers, I think, was the slogan for the group originally. Sort of coming together, and then there was a period of time there, the late 90s up to about 2000, when it was very active. It was the list to be on. But gradually it got eclipsed. Gradually the members drifted off. They joined other mailing lists that were more specific to their topic, and after I get back home, in fact, about 3 or 4 days after I get home, I'm going down the road to Fredericton for the 10th annual NAWEB conference. NAWEB, North American Web, is the conference that developed out of www.dev. It's the 10th, and it's the last. and we'll be in the memorable stage. And there'll be lots of reflecting, lots of looking back, and we'll shut it down nice and clean and say, job well done. And so they do have this life cycle, and every site that I've seen has gone through this. There are some out there now that are still in various stages of being communities of practice. Blogging. I talk about blogging quite a bit, have recently. We're kind of sort of in the, we've passed the potential, we're in the, oh, I should be pointing at this, not my screen here. We're in the sort of coalescing and active stage. Blogging will disperse. People will go on to other things. We're already sort of seeing things. I saw a post the other day, blogger burnout. Turns out, if you're writing stuff every day, some people run out of stuff to write about. Who would have believed? And so they go and they do other things with their lives. So, but we'll look back on blogging, we'll say, what an era that was. It's like the personal homepage. We just had a flowering for a while. GeoCities. Who goes to GeoCities anymore? Nowadays, if I see a GeoCities link in Google, I think, that site's probably down. Aha, see? In some cases, not even memorable. GeoCities was a site that was set up that allowed any person to create a home page on the World Wide Web for free. So basically, you went to GeoCities, you had a page editing screen, you could choose a template, a lot like Blogger, except it was for a home page, and you just built your home page. There was another one that was big too, and I always forget the name of it. Angel Fire. Angel Fire was huge as well. Angel Fire is like almost completely shut down now. Oops, that's not the one I wanted. Next, please. There we go. There's a lot of talk about, there have been like stacks of literature now on communities of practice in the business. And the main thing that this literature says is it's not a business unit. It's separate from the business units. It's an informal channel of communication. I have seen stuff that talk about the connections within a business being the community of practice in a business as opposed to the hierarchical structure. Is it hierarchical or hierarchical? I'm really confused on that now because I did spell check the other day and it came out hierarchical, but it's Microsoft, so I don't trust it. So anyhow, I think hierarchical. Pardon? It's probably in Wikipedia. You're probably right, yeah. But you may have seen this in some of the business books, and they actually do network diagrams of the connections between individuals in an organization, and the network diagrams look very different from the diagram on the organizational structure, and it'll look something like this. Get rid of that because that was pretty ugly drawing anyways. And what's neat is they actually superimpose. So you have your hierarchy. I have no idea how this is showing up on the camera, and if it's not, sorry. you have your neat corporate hierarchy. And this is the NRC. Right, so this is me. So you have your corporate hierarchy, and then you overlay the corporate hierarchy with things like, for example, email messages sent from one person to another, because you can track these in the corporate hierarchy because, of course, you have no rights. So it's fairly easy. But you get a pattern that looks something like this. Now, the question you ask here is, who's doing the job, right? And who's actually running the company? And the informal network, the underlying network in a corporate hierarchy is very often very different from the formal network. Here, actually, this is a pretty well-connected CEO. he actually talks to two people. It's extremely well connected. This person, basically don't talk to their supervisor. They go through this person who does talk and talks to everybody down here. So this is, the irony is, this is the person who will get fired. Because it's also the position of the greatest risk, right? But sometimes you see things like, you know, somebody here. Right. That's not actually that uncommon. It's that everybody knows that, you know, this is the person that knows how to do, say, Word. He's the person in the company who understands Word. And without doing an analysis of this sort, it's very possible for a company like this, because they always cut from the bottom, to cut off their organizational knowledge of Microsoft Word. And they don't realize that they've crippled themselves. But these networks are informal. They can't be controlled. Companies do try to control them, but you couldn't control this sort of thing. The very best you can do is kind of tweak it. But how do you tweak it? Right? How do you tell this person, talk to your boss? I mean, the person probably already knows that's what they're supposed to do. So you can't just sort of go and say, hey, build a network connection, because that's not how network connections work. They don't get created, they get grown. There has to be something in common between the boss and this person that would actually encourage them to communicate. This is Hebbian association as a network again. If they have nothing in common, they're not going to forge a link. And there's no way you can do it. The best you can do is put them in the same room, but then they'll just sort of sit there. Or worse, they'll start fighting or something like that. Oops, keep doing that and it keeps not working. This sort of diagram gives you the sense of the functions and the functionality of a community practice, the exchange and interpretation of information. You can see this person basically is the company clearinghouse, right? You want to know something, you ask this person. The only person actually who isn't in the know in this company is this person, who never talks to this person. One of the functions of the CEO should be to identify that person and have lunch with them. To retain knowledge, to be the steward of competencies. That's like the person who understands Microsoft Word. Sure, you know, they're a junior clerk in the shipping department, but you know, it's a hobby. Home for identities. I don't know about that. I don't like that. The last time I did this, I didn't like that either. How do I want to say that? Because people do have identities in communities of practice. My identity online is Labatt. You might say, why Labatt? Well, the community that I first joined was a MUD. And in a MUD, you have to come up with a name. And I don't want to just use my name, because nobody uses their own name. They use like the names of gods and wizards. So we had a Kurgan, and we had a Thor, and we had, oh, I forget what we had, a Kringled, and you can tell the ones that influenced me, so on and so forth. So I chose Labatt because I was sitting with a group of friends, and they said, you know, you got to join this. And I said, yeah, okay, that sounds good. And their names, one of them was named Cain, and the other one was named Nomad. And so they're saying, well, you got to pick a name. And what name should I pick? Well, it's got to be easy to type, because it was all text-based. So go with something that, you know, will really flow off. And I'm sort of looking around, what would, you know, sort of like double letters, things like that, that really helps. So, you know, or repeated letters. So I'm looking around at the bar, And I see the big sign of Labatt Breweries. So I named myself after a beer. And it's stuck with me ever since. I'm still Labatt. That's my identity online. And in various discussion lists and things like that, I sign on as Labatt. Probably won't find that up on, under Google a whole lot, because a lot of these, you know, like identities in MUDs and things like that aren't the sorts of things that show up in Google. But my other name is Labatt. I do have another name and a whole other identity, Labatt the Cat. So that's the origin of communities of practice, and then it like ossified, it kind of froze, it became corporatized, it became, I'm looking for other words that mean stasis, but you get the idea, it became inert. And it did so mostly because of a book by people called Hegel and Armstrong called Net.Gain. I can probably pull it up here. Let's try a little multimedia. Oh, it's going to be slow on me now. Why is it going to be slow? I will never understand Microsoft. I won't. There we go. That other one's just not going to go. Why does it take a long time to display my web browser? This doesn't happen to me in Linux. Come on. See, this is the new student thing again. Like, it's making me wait. I don't want to wait. There's no reason for it to wait except for programming incompetence. Something's really bogging it down. Oops. Now we do all that again. Okay, never mind. Microsoft lets me down. Yes, again. Anyhow, Hegel and Armstrong published this book called Net Gain. And the concept of Net Gain was you too can create a community of practice for fun and profit. So here are the things that, now the idea of Net Gain was that what you were going to do when you created a community of practice is you were going to go for a vertical market segment. And the example that they used throughout the book was the travel industry. And so what you were going to do on the Net Gain model is set up this travel website. And you would basically create a community of practice around the topic of travel and travel agency. And the idea here was you'll get all your customers to come to this community of practice and you'll be able to make a whole bunch of sales and then pocket a commission. That was the business model. And they had your standard Harvard business model graphics. And that went out. Well, in reality, it went because we had a tech crash. But that was the model. So here's what Hegel and Armstrong said were the guiding principles for your community of practice. Distinct focus, right? Travel. If you went to this community of practice, you'd find stuff about travel, where to go, how to fly, what hotels to book, so on and so forth. The capacity, and this was and still is an important one, to integrate content and communication. It's something that the online learning world has never gotten quite right. The idea was that content and communication would be in the same place, indeed on the same screen at the same time. So you'd have the content and you'd have the interaction around the content, all right there. Member-generated content was a big thing, because what made the community of practice work is the contribution of the members, because the information was genuine. It was more likely to be true. It wasn't just advertising material or promotional material. It was the real-life reflections of people. And even today, if you go buying a book on Amazon, the thing that you'll read in order to determine whether you want to buy the book is not the book cover or stuff like that. It's the members' reviews of the book, typically. So, of course, naturally, people started gaming the member reviews. So you have the authors going in and reviewing their own books. But they get caught when they do that. Another aspect of community of practice that was very important, and something I still pull from that to this day, is access to multiple and competing publishers and vendors. You would never get a community of practice, well, I shouldn't say never, there are in some cases, but typically in a topic-specific community of practice, you'll get contributions, content, and information from all of the vendors involved in that particular area. This is why things haven't worked as well in the music industry as the publishers would like, because they keep trying to set up, you know, the Sony music site or the Columbia music site. Name me the last person who bought their music from one record label. And it doesn't happen. People want their content coming, their product coming from a variety of vendors. When I travel, when I go to travel, well, here, I don't demonstrate loyalty to a particular airline. I demonstrate loyalty to the airline that will actually take me to where I want to go. Which is why in Australia I flew Qantas instead of Air Canada. I've determined that Air Canada's connections in this country, not good. It's interesting because companies fight against that, right? The frequent flyer program to get you to try to be loyal to an airline. But if you think about it, who would be loyal to an airline? Even if you do have frequent flyer points, which you can never actually redeem anyways. But they do try that. And that's what a lot of this loyalty programs are about, is to go against your natural inclination to buy products from a company that will actually give you what you want. And the net gain mantra, commercial orientation, this is what changed communities of practice. The idea that you were going to make money off of this thing. It spawned, oh, I don't know how many hundreds of these sites, of which they remain, I don't know, none. Why would people go to a community of practice? Here's what Hagel and Armstrong told us. Reduce search cost. Therefore, increase propensity for customers to buy. You don't go to a travel site unless you actually intend to travel at some point. Better targeted marketing. You're targeting the people who are actually interested in that particular topic. You can tailor your products, add value. There was a great book by authors called Shapiro and Varian called Information Rules. It was a neat little play on words, right? It's either information rules, here are the rules for dealing with information, or information rules. And yeah, I like that title. Basically, the point that Shapiro and Varian made in their book is that a lot of the tactics, a lot of the mechanisms that are used in business outside the digital domain also apply in the digital domain. For example, targeted pricing. Pricing people or setting higher price points to people who are more likely to pay for them. Setting price points based on preferences, price points based on supply, things like that. Bundling. They talk a lot about bundling and how to bundle products and services. Let's face it, nobody really uses Microsoft Access, but everyone has it. That's bundling. What Hagel and Armstrong called disintermediation, well, not just them, but many other people, the idea is that you're cutting past the middleman. And this is what's made sites like Amazon and eBay so attractive to vendors, especially or producers of products, is, you know, you don't have 8 layers of retail chain to get through to get to the customer. So you're able to reduce a lot of those middleman costs. Although you, as the owner of the community of practice, are taking your 5% off the top. Turns out, as Steve Bezos would say, it's enough to make you rich. Here's Minimal. Let's see what happens if I click on the link. Sometime eventually, Windows will serve this up. But Minimal is a community of practice that I developed, as I said, from the municipal sector in Alberta. Notice the neat, stylish oval. You don't see that, do you? Basically, it was intended to be a community of practice for the municipal sector in Alberta. And again, it was classic vertical marketing. We went for everybody from people working in the municipal affairs ministry in the provincial government through to elected officials, mayors, town council members, administrative staff, town managers, things like that. And also the intent was, and was actually successful, was to reach suppliers, vendors, anybody who would cater to the municipal market. The thing with Minimal, I see it's never going to show me that website. The thing about Minimal was it was set up in this classic net gain model. And we're all set, we're, you know, have all the vendors there and all the products and the discussion areas and that, so if you were a municipal administrator, you could buy a new grader for your town off of Unimall. And in Alberta, they have an organization called the Alberta Urban Municipalities Association. And the Alberta Urban Municipalities Association basically went on the warpath against Unimall because it had the idea that it would profit from all of these online transactions. We also ran into a bit of an issue with an organization called MERCS. MERCS has had and has the monopoly on government tendering in Canada, and you have to sign up and pay a subscription to access MERCS. That's a nice monopoly if you can get it. I had a deal worked out with MERCS. I couldn't work a deal with AUMA. AUMA wanted everything lock, stock, and barrel. As a result, there is no commercial services portal for municipal sector in Alberta now. Unimall changed its focus and became strictly an education, learning, and resource site rather than a commercial site. That refocus saved it. Otherwise, it would have died completely. But it became, nonetheless, even though it wasn't commercially oriented, and possibly because it wasn't commercially oriented, indispensable to the municipal community in Alberta. It still exists today, and if this silly machine would do anything like do what I wanted it to, well, there's that search I wanted. No, it's simply not going to do it, is it? I think you really have to target the search. I've never heard of a proper index to communities of practice. I think that's probably because the concept is still very fuzzy. So it's not the sort of thing that you wouldn't search for typically communities of practice. You'd search for the topic, whatever the topic is. Very often, though, if you search for a topic or area in Google, after you get past the commercial sites, which are at least fake communities of practice, then you'll probably hit some communities of practice. Here's Unimall. And you can see the integration of discussion and content, the discussion area, so on and so forth. I haven't looked at this for a little while. Here's the attempts, I talked about this yesterday, to link Unimall up with courses. They're still plugging these courses. I don't know why, but they are. Events listings. What else? Here's what saved Unimall. Is the Unimall newsletter. If this format looks familiar, it should. The format, and indeed even the software for Unimall newsletter, is the same format, the same software I use to do my own newsletter in OL Daily. And in fact, the Unimall newsletter came into existence just because I recognize that the best way to build the community of practice at that time, and to this day still, I think, is through something like a regular newsletter. Now, the Unimall newsletter is weekly, or it was the last time I looked. And it's organized quite a bit differently than I would organize mine. Because there's so much content, it really should be daily, but because there's so much content, they've actually set it up in sections. I didn't have the sections in it. Oh, and they have advertising now. For themselves. Okay. So an awful lot of stuff here. The way this was supposed to work and didn't. I set it up to work this way, and then my job was basically to build Unimall and then move on, and that's exactly what I did. But the idea was, as you signed up for Unimall, you would indicate what province you were from, and then you would get a Unimall newsletter tailored to your specific province. For those of you who don't know, province is like a state here in Alberta, here in Australia. They just simply had different sections for different provinces. And the thinking there was that people in one province would be interested in what people in other provinces are doing. That's a choice they made. I'm cool with that. And it's doing very well. Almost 3,000 subscribers. Alberta's a province of about 1 million 1.5 million people. The municipal sector isn't that large. They have 3,000 subscribers. They basically got the lock on that market. I find that interesting. It's so nice to come back to this and see it's still going, because I worked very hard to build that. So, and especially with that AUMA stuff, there was a real chance that it was going to be killed before it even launched. Actually, it was a classic government initiative. Muni Mall was actually launched by the provincial government before they hired me to build it. And then they had a second launch the week before I got there. And we finally got it built, and they said, let's have a launch. I said, are you nuts? So we had what they call a quiet launch or a stealth launch. We just unrolled it. And the thing with Muni Mall, too, the other thing with Muni Mall, and this is not Hagel and Armstrong, but it should be. I sent out an email to every single person in the municipal sector in Alberta, and I got about 200 subscriptions out of that. And what really made Muni Mall was going to municipal conferences in person with a booth and a setup like this and showing people and signing them up on the spot. That's what that community still needed, was that. And I find that with my own newsletter as well. When I go to a conference or something like that, I'll get a spike in subscriptions. So if you haven't signed up for my newsletter yet, if you go to downs.ca, how's that for a segue? Go to downs.ca and you go into the newsletter, which is news. Oops. Let's try that again. Sometimes if I click links too fast, it forgets it's a web page. Now it's going to stop. They call this high speed, but they lie. Oh, well. Anyhow, I'll come back to that once it loads, if it ever loads. And I'll show you how to subscribe to my newsletter if you're interested. If you're not, that's fine. Anyhow, the objective of Muni Mall was to get information and communication from then non-virtual channels into the internet, to get the knowledge of the community that they would typically access by picking up the phone and calling someone into this virtual forum, so it would be easier to communicate online rather than by the telephone. Turns out that never happened. Turns out it's still easier, even today, in the municipal sector in Alberta to pick up a phone and call someone. And that makes sense. I mean, it's hard to make a computer as easy as a phone. And nobody's done that yet. We're not to that point yet. That's why there are all kinds of people running around with cell phones. They're so much easier to use than going, starting up your computer, maybe getting Windows to boot up properly, maybe not, who knows. So it wasn't so much of a success in that way. But we tried to do things phones couldn't do, like have a repository of information. And the thing with Muni Mall, you saw the Muni Mall newsletter, every single one of those items is in a database. And it's a searchable database with topics organized according to regular expression so that you can have very specific information on any given topic that you want. And then it was meant to be communications, trade, and common culture. Trade was vetoed, communication was done by the telephone, and common culture was created at conferences. So none of those three things really happened with Muni Mall. But nonetheless, because it's such a useful information resource, people still go to it. They still use it, and the government funds it. The government has to fund it now because there is no commercial support for it. But the thing is, it became valuable enough that the municipal community itself lobbied the government to make sure that Muni Mall continued to be funded in its operations. It doesn't get very much. I think it gets something like $80,000 or $100,000 a year, give or take, which basically is a staff person and the server and setup and ancillary expenses. And that's basically what it costs to run Muni Mall now. So from my perspective, given the time, given the market, it was probably about as much of a success as could be hoped. we ran into interesting issues with Munival. Turns out municipal administrators don't like talking about business in the open. Who knew? In retrospect, probably should have seen that coming, but didn't know that at the time. The competition with the telephone, the disruption, like, and this is the thing with Munimall, is it was an imposed thing, right? It was a provincial government project, and it was intended to set up one of these, but in so doing, it disrupted this, right? Because it was an official thing, and you have an official red thing, then your green thing is disrupted. And that was the key problem with Munimall, was the fact that it was being imposed by the provincial government. And then just simply the how convenient it was, how easy it was to start up your computer, dial up the internet, and actually access this thing. Because back then, the municipal offices basically only had dial-up networking. Today, of course, municipalities in Alberta are hooked up with Alberta SuperNet, so they can just have always-on internet access. But back then, it really was the case of getting them to dial in to their telephone internet connection. Here's community of practice in my life, phase two. Phase two was a project called Pegasus. And Pegasus was intended to be a community of practice for the engineering, geology, and geophysical sector in Alberta. It was organized with their association. The association was called APEGA, Association of Petroleum Engineers, Geologists, and Geophysicists of Alberta. And what it was intended to do was to provide one-stop shopping for all the learning opportunities that anybody in this field would need. The big problem that these people had is that training for people in this sector came from a multitude of sources. There's 40, 50 different providers, quite literally. A lot of them providing overlapping content, competing content. It was very hard to find training opportunities. It was very hard to sign up for training opportunities. They all had their own different registration system and so on. So with APEGA, what we tried to do is create a single learning and information marketplace. And we based that specifically on a paper that I wrote called The Learning Marketplace. So, and that's what, and Pegasus did launch. It launched last November, so it's almost a year old now. It is running. One of the nice things about my projects is they do actually persist even after I'm gone, which makes me very happy. So, oops, okay, I don't have a discussion page back there. Pegasus kind of worked. I say kind of because the model that was supposed to be used for Pegasus was the RSS model that I have talked about and we'll talk about later on in this section. The idea was that for learning opportunities, the providers were supposed to provide information in the form of metadata. This metadata would be aggregated by the Pegasus system, tossed into a database, and then be accessible as a searchable database or a customized individual feed based on a profile that the members would create on Pegasus itself. Now what happened, and then the developers got a hold of it, and they turned it into a shopping cart site, and that wasn't what I had in mind. But I sort of pulled back from that a little bit. But the first big problem was the providers wouldn't play. The providers all wanted to have their own special way of presenting course information, course content. In fact, they wanted to provide courses rather than the short, to-the-point learning opportunities that the professionals in the field had indicated in the surveys that they were looking for. We have people that are out on oil pipelines. They're out in the middle of nowhere. They have access really only via their cell phone to the internet. So this is a cell phone showing up on a PDA-sized device. They don't have time for a 39-hour course. What they do need is valve alignment, and they need it now. Couldn't get providers to provide learning in that format. Couldn't get providers to provide the information in anything like metadata. So Pegasus had to hire a person who would basically coddle the providers and get the information from them and enter it manually into the database. It really killed the business model, because the business model was based on there being an automatic stream of content. On the other side of it, the idea was supposed to be that when the resource was presented, the person would just click on it and access it, and then billing would take place, typically to their employer. That didn't happen either, because, again, the providers didn't want you just clicking on something and accessing a resource. They wanted you to apply for admission to entry into their program and stuff like that. So it was never simple and straightforward. And as far as payment was concerned, the providers wanted you to go through their payment system rather than through the payment system that Pegasus would provide. So it turned out that the student still had to do a separate payment arrangement with the provider and then get reimbursed by their employer. So I did a lot of grumbling during this project. It didn't help either that I changed employers halfway through and moved to the NRC, so I wasn't able to be there to browbeat the providers and to browbeat even the companies who were supposed to set up the payment systems. Nonetheless, Pegasus still exists. It still works. It is used by the petroleum engineers, geologists, geophysicists, and that. But interestingly, not to buy learning opportunities, because they found it very inconvenient to use Pegasus to actually purchase learning. Big surprise. I did tell them about all of that going in. But they do use it. And what's made Pegasus work is that any APEGA event, a speaker, a seminar, a meeting, all of those are also being input as learning opportunities. So they've redefined learning a little bit. They've widened the definition. But we still don't have the nice, neat, little bite-sized pieces of learning that APEGA was supposed to provide in the first place. So there's still a lot of potential for this model, but it didn't work the way it was intended, mostly because the providers were not willing, in my view, to tailor their learning to the market that they were supposed to be addressing. Go ahead.
Has there been an informal process generated out of that? For example, does anyone put out a call to say, how the hell do you fix a Monarch Bell one and do it?
I haven't seen it. No, because they didn't really build the communications area. There is a discussion list. The last time I looked, it had one post, and it was, this discussion list is yours to use, kind of post. But no, they haven't been using it. Again, they still use the telephone, call each other. It's hard to do better than the telephone. And people need to understand that. The only time you can do better than the telephone is if you're working at very long distances, and there you don't have a convenience advantage, you have a price advantage. But for even something like intra-provincial calls, it costs money. It might cost $3 or $4 a call, but to the engineer, the convenience is worth it. So. I'm like that too. I don't use the telephone. A lot of people do. The bulk of people do. Most people. And the reason is, in my view, because computer technology is nowhere near as simple to use as the telephone. I think, and it's nowhere near as, these days, as portable as the telephone. If we were competing only with landlines, it'd be a lot easier. But now we're competing with mobile phones as well. But the thing is, well, until my IP phones were installed, you did not need to read a manual to use a phone. You did not need to use special software to use a phone. You picked up a phone. It was always on. It always worked. Every time you hit the number, you'd get the person on the other end, or at least their answering machine, right? There were. Well, I mean.
Correction of any interpretation or it would have any
Yeah, there is the intermediate technology, of course, of instant messaging, which is wildly popular, especially in its SMS form, so that you can have instant messaging on your telephone. So it's not so much the audio properties of the phone, I think, and I say that just because of the uptake of SMS, which is completely textual. Oh, textual and symbols a little bit too, but I really think it's the ease of use is the key factor here, rather than the audio. The audio is appropriate in some circumstances, as you say, to avoid misunderstandings and things like that. But people who are used to a text-based environment are able to work around that. So I hardly ever have misunderstandings based on email anymore. I have many more based on the telephone, which is why I don't use it. The telephone can't tell you when I'm waving my hand or grinning to indicate a joke or something like that. So, you know, I mean, to a large degree, it's a pattern of preferences. To a large degree, it's a generational thing, what we grew up with versus what the new technology is. But I think the key thing is we're just not to that point in computer technology yet where it's easier to have a conversation over the computer than to have a conversation over a telephone. My observation, and probably yours, is it takes a lot longer using the computer, it takes a lot more work using the computer, and it's a lot less likely to work properly using a computer. So I think those would be the major factors. But those of you who are in design, the target you're aiming for is the telephone. If your design isn't as easy to use, as fast and efficient as the telephone, it will be rooted around. So long as there is a possibility to do it another way, it will be done another way. You're also, I mean, for that matter, the television is similarly effective competing technology. The television, you click it, it's on. Right? There's no boot up process for the television. It's just on. You click the channels. You always get the channels you expect to get. And you don't get different channels, or you don't get channel not available very often. At least we don't in Canada. I don't know about here. And at home, we get lots of channels. So, I mean, that's the expectation. Click it, it's on. Click a channel, it's there. This is all the new student stuff, right? You know, there's no delay. There's no manual that you need to study in order to learn a television. If the television doesn't work as you expect it, you just keep trying things until it does work. And if that doesn't happen, you replace the television with one that does work. You know, because the previous television was obviously broken. So that's the standard. I try to tell people about that kind of standard. I have a talk and a paper called 9 Rules for Good Technology, which if you're tootling around my website, I really recommend that you have a look at. That is the standard. Elevators. Imagine elevators needed a boot-up process. Imagine an elevator would sometimes take you to the wrong floor just because. What happens if an elevator crashes? You know, it used to be the case that we had to have elevator operators, but they really became popular when people learned how to push the floor buttons for themselves and were able to do it for themselves. I mean, that's the standard. If your online training isn't as easy to use, as obvious to use as an elevator, it's broken. And people will use something else. Simple. Sure. So where are we going? Nice picture. That's Saskatoon, by the way. You wouldn't think. Normally you think of Saskatoon, you think cold, snowy, blizzard. But that's Saskatoon in May. That's what it looks like in May. A lot like out there. Except with different kinds of trees. Our trees in Canada, the bark isn't all falling off. And the branches and limbs don't fall on you. It's actually safe to be in a forest in Canada. Self-pruning, yes. Yeah. We have a self-pruning mechanism in Canada, too. It's called winter. So here's what you are if you're not designing to make your content as easy to use as a telephone. Communities of practice are not broadcast channels. They're not marketing devices. They're not even learning devices. Learning communities, the primary focus is not learning. The primary focus is the conversation. The primary focus of a community, any kind of community of practice, learning, business, whatever, is the network. Getting people connected to each other, getting them having conversations with each other. This references to a document called the Clue Train Manifesto. If you haven't seen the Clue Train Manifesto, you should go have a look at it. It was written, when was it written? 98, 99, something like that. And I'm very proud to say, pat myself on the back because it's famous now, I was one of the original signatories to it, although I was certainly not the author of it. It's at cluetrain.com. This is the story. This is the same marketplace story. This is the same democracy story. This is the same network story. We are moving in communities of practice from the power, the management of the organization, to the power or the management of the individual. It's the individual whose needs, interests, and desires are more important than the organizational needs or desires. It's what the individual wants to read and what the individual wants to say that far, far outweighs any message that somebody's trying to get to them. And this applies as much in learning as it does in business or commerce. The mantra that we're hearing a lot of these days is that learning is about the conversation rather than about the content. And when I talk to people about learning content and learning objects, the picture I have in my mind now is that a learning object, a piece of learning content, is something that's not created by an instructor, and goodness knows, not created by a publisher, but a learning object is something created by a student. And it's a piece of learning, it can be reused, but really a learning object is like a word in a conversation that students have with each other. And the learning moves back and forward. It's not broadcast from some central authority. It's the community talking to itself. Now, when you ask, well, how could somebody learn in that sort of environment? Well, you immerse yourself. You join the community, and you watch the conversation flow. And then as you get more aware of it, you're able to begin to take part in that conversation. It's a model we see repeated over and over and over again on the internet. My website is an example of that. My website is not a broadcast. Yeah, it's me talking, but it's not me talking as an expert. It's not me talking as a guru. It's my space. It's my spot on the internet where I talk. And if you wanted to learn about instructional technology, the first thing I would say is start reading other sites. Go to other places as well. My website is one node in the network that we would call the Community of Practice for Learning Technology. And what are the other nodes, you might ask? And we'll try to go there quickly rather than slowly, which we have been doing so far. Here are the other nodes. Now, these are the nodes I think are in the network. This is the EduRSS contributing feed. So we have Derek Slater, we have Aaron Campbell, Derek Morrison, David Wiley, Stephen Mosel, Bill Brandon, Kim Cavanaugh, Alan Levine, so on and so forth down the line. These are the people that I converse with in my daily practice